You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Cadbury's shrinking chocolate bars. How very dare they? Super Bowl commercials, the return of the Pirate Bay, newspaper cartoons, and we review BBC Two's Inside the Commons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. It's another blast of the Parish Council. This is your podcast from the Rocking Vicar. Glad you could make it. I'm Magnus Shaw, and turn a different corner and we never would have met, but we did. It's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello.
Oh, now, just wait a minute. Didn't we roll out a podcast last week? I think we did one last week.
Did one last week, yeah.
Well, you see, we're back too soon.
Yes,
because following this week's news that Harper Lee is publishing a new novel after 60 years, a week feels like the blink of an eye.
Well, that's some hiatus, isn't it? And she hasn't spent 60 years writing it, though, has she?
She had it in the can, didn't she? Yes, she had it in a cupboard. But, you know, Harper Lee isn't the first to leave a 60-year gap. I've been thinking about, where 60 gaps are, they're quite common because Blue Nile albums, they only appear every 60 years.
That's infrequent, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Samantha Cameron's company, the stationers, Smithsons, that they only pay their taxes every 60 years.
Yeah, I can well imagine that they do, yes.
Yeah. The Super Bowl halftime show, that doesn't count because that only feels like it lasts for 60 years. But Magnus Shaw, I hear you're celebrating British Telecom buying the mobile firm EE for £12.5 billion. because phone companies, they're just your favourite thing in the world.
They've been my mortal enemies for the last two and a bit weeks. Both EE and British Telecom. EE in the guise of Orange, which I think they've
just... You love them.
Well, yeah, a week last Saturday, I woke up and found I had no landline telephone into my house at all. There was no dial tone. And I thought, this surely is easily fixed. You just put in a call on your mobile and somebody at the exchange or somebody in a van comes and restores your telephone.
Oh, you poor naive man.
Oh, no. But the mixture of telephone calls and emails and indeed tweets, I have fought valiantly against the forces of bureaucracy to get my landline restored. A fellow in a van did arrive yesterday.
Knowing where you live, was it a horse-drawn van?
He may have been more efficient if it had been, now he's left me in a situation where if I plug my telephone in, my internet goes down, and if I have my internet up, there's no dial tone on the telephone, it still has not been rectified. I'm not here to pour my woes across the listeners, or indeed across you, but I did just want to share with you one of the tweets that I received. And it's worth mentioning that I only managed to get communication with EEE this was with the telephone provider actually. I only managed to raise them over Twitter, get a response from them over Twitter. Polite please, I have no dial-up tone, please help, attracted no response whatsoever. I only got a response when I said, hey everybody, if you're thinking of changing your home phone, please don't change it to insert name of provider here, because they flatly refused to respond to you here on Twitter. Within an hour, I got a response. Isn't that funny, isn't it?
Yeah, that's curious, isn't it? Yeah, there's a thing.
Anyway, after much to-ing and fro-ing, I asked why I still hadn't had a fella in a horse-drawn van come to my modest abode and fix my
daub and wattle house
to fix the problem. And here's what they said on direct message. Over Twitter. Here's what they said. Okay, their explanation. Okay. Thus, the engineer visit is to ensure that this is resolved as quickly as possible for you. The update we are awaiting is in regards to the work which has been done already in regards to restoring this to normal, which is what we will inform you once this becomes available. Immediately, it was all clear to me.
Oh, well, that's, you know, that couldn't be clearer, could it? So that means, I can't, no, I don't think any of us can understand that at all.
No, it was extraordinary. And obviously, Leah lifted straight from the pages of Franz Kafka there.
Only a guess is that they've got draft responses that they use, and they've, you know, thought, well, we'll take a bit of that one and a bit of that one and a bit of that one.
Stitch several of them together.
That'll be some young 18-year-old, you know, trying to make his way in the telecoms business, and he's been given the social media gig for his pains.
Well, lordy, lordy. What an explanation. I'm still none the wiser. I mean, like I say, a chappie did arrive yesterday and has seems to really excelled himself by making matters considerably worse.
Oh, that's right. And they always disappear over the horizon. Their van is just going around the corner when you discover that you still haven't got broadband or
a phone. Well, I said line. This is going to leave me with landline and broadband, isn't it? And he said, yes, that's right. And I said, let me just have a look at the broadband then. And I looked at my laptop and said, no, there's no broadband up here. And he said, oh, that's all right. It takes a couple of minutes for it to all settle down. You'll have
it.
And away he went. So, yeah. And then I had to spend an hour trying to figure out what was going on. And the closest I've got to a resolution is unplug all the phones and the broadband comes up. Plug all the phones in and the broadband bank goes down, so you choose. What should we have today, darling? Do you fancy the telephone or the internet? We have to choose over breakfast.
Well, that's a big story, but we can't ignore the big but getting smaller story of the week. Yeah. And that's the news that Cadbury are shrinking the size of its chocolate bars by 10%, but not reducing the cost. We should be out protesting in the streets, because that means a distressing and heartbreaking one row fewer in each Cadbury chocolate bar. And this news comes less than a month after the scandal of the Cadbury cream egg, when the company decided that they were no longer going to use Dairy Milk chocolate for the shell, switching to, and I quote, standard cocoa mix chocolate. Then they reduced the Cadbury cream egg multi-packs from 6 down to 5. Everything we thought we knew has changed, Magnus Shaw. Stop the world. I want to get off.
This is rip-off Britain.
It is rip-off
Britain, yeah. Yes, I mean, it's shocking. I guess they had to be upfront about this, because it would only be a matter of moments before the world realised what they'd done. So I suppose they had to preempt that. Have they given any kind of torturous explanation as to why this is a good thing, not a bad thing?
Yes, they have. The world chocolate market is in crisis. Prices are going up at base level, so they could either pass on the price increases to you, the consumer, or reduce the size of the chocolate bars, but so charge you the same.
So they're doing you a favour.
That's how their PR people are spinning it. But although
all I was going to say was that what they can fall back on is your health fascists, isn't it? Who would probably support them and say, well, this is good. You're consuming less cocoa solids, fewer sugars in our diets is exactly what we want. So bravo, Cadbury. I'm surprised they haven't wheeled somebody out to give that line, really.
Yeah, well, this Cadbury business is definitely about chocolate bars getting smaller. I've discovered that sometimes it's not the chocolate bars getting smaller, it's us getting bigger. And I'll explain that, because I tweeted that wagon wheels seem smaller these days. And someone from Burton's Biscuits, in a friendly but very aerated way, assured me that they're exactly the same size as they've ever been. No. It's my hand that's got bigger.
No.
And so wagon wheels look smaller.
No, this is some kind of illusion. This is some kind of magic trick they're trying to pull on you here.
Well.
They used to be as big as your head, the wagon wheel, didn't it?
That was
the whole point. The clue's in the name, isn't it? It was a wagon wheel. Supposed to be able to put your family on top of one and float down a river. They were that big.
Well, you know, I can only tell you what Burton's Biscuits Twitter account have told me that they're the same times as they've ever been. But the snack industry, this is good, they've got a word for food items getting smaller.
Oh, and really?
Yeah, they call it shrinkflation. So if you get...
No, that doesn't work at all.
If you get fewer crisps in a bag or fewer biscuits in a packet,
yeah.
Shrinkflation, same price, smaller product.
Shrinkflation. Yeah, but inflation comes from flatus, doesn't it? Which is the Latin word for wind, isn't it? Or air, flatus. Mm-hmm. The air that emanates from certain unmentionable parts is called flatus, isn't it? And those are the same root word for flation, inflation, and that means to fill with air. So you can't, it's deflation is what they mean, isn't it? They mean deflation, not what was it? Shrinkflation.
Shrinkflation, yes.
Well,
yes,
no, that's nonsense. That is that's a terrible approach to the English language, and makes no sense.
I'm going to pass on your thoughts to Burton's Biscuits and Cadbury, and I'll tell you if they come back to me.
I'll give them shrinkflation.
No, shrinkflation. You're not a sports fan, Magnus Shaw.
No, nothing.
Unlike me, you won't have been up until 4 a.m. last Monday watching the Seattle Seahawks throw away their chance of beating the New England Patriots in the very last seconds of the Super Bowl.
Really?
Very exciting it was as well. Mm. There is an element of American football to the Super Bowl, but mainly it's about finding out how long NBC can string out the pre-game analysis to longer than the actual game itself.
Yeah.
Then it's about checking to see if the celebrity selected to sing the Star Spangled Banner bashes it out in the manner of a braying donkey. Then there's the halftime show in which a pop star comes out and lip-syncs their greatest hits while people dressed up as sharks dance awkwardly out of time.
Oh, well, we need to know who did the Star Spangled Banner. Who sang it?
Oh, it was the lady from Frozen. What's her name?
Oh, yeah, well.
Idina Menzel.
Oh, well, good choice.
Yeah. She was very good.
Yeah, nothing bigger than Frozen. It's the phenomenon that's sweeping the world, particularly those children's parties.
Those children's parties, which we referred to last week.
Absolutely.
Magnus Shaw, in and amongst the obscene touchdown celebrations, there are, of course, the commercials for which companies paid $4.5 million for a single slot in 2015.
30 seconds you get for that.
You do indeed.
Oh, and one play. Yeah.
One play for $4.5 million.
I know.
One glue company filled up that used their entire budget for the year for their entire advertising budget for the year one commercial at the Super
Amazing.
Bowl. There were some great commercials this year. There was a Brady Bunch mashup and a Katie Couric Brian Gumbel ad for BMW. They would be my favourites. But a commercial that got a lot of people saying, whoa, what happened there, was for Nationwide, in which, and I'm a bit of a big spoiler here if you haven't seen it, a Nationwide ad in which a kid dies.
Yeah.
As our advertising and branding guru, what the hell were Nationwide thinking with their Make Safe Happen commercial?
We should point out this is Nationwide, the American insurance giants, not the building society in the UK. That's right. I'll tell you what they were thinking of. They were thinking that people like you and I, and perish the thought, even more important people, would be talking about it once it had aired. And here we are doing so. I guess your question is, does this kind of thing work? It probably does. The sheer dint of the fact that it's caused a stir, which is disruption, is the whole point of advertising. But is it appropriate? I think this kind of thing is appropriate when the campaign is awareness raising for an international emergency or an ongoing health crisis, HIV or whatever. The appropriateness diminishes somewhat when it's for a commercial concern, which, of course, as we all know, an insurance company is a commercial concern. But the principal problem here, I don't think really, is whether we should have been introduced to a young child who's lost his life in an accident. We don't see that happen.
No.
He's telling this as a ghost, really, isn't he? I have seen that before, but I have seen it for public information and awareness campaigns rather than a commercial venture. So my biggest problem here was the strap line that ends the commercial. Mm. Well, I found that far more troubling. It says, make safe happen.
Make safe happen.
Look, you dolts. Safe is an adjective. You can't make adjectives happen, you donuts. As a copywriter of many years standing, I found that more troubling than the storyline of the commercial. It has been done before, but I think always for not-for-profit purposes. So I guess it was the fact that it was a commercial venture that caused the stir. But I didn't find it offensive. It tugged at the heartstrings, which is what it was supposed to do. Yeah.
Yes, I think that I understand the message, but the thing about was it the right platform to air it is, I suppose, based on the notion that the Super Bowl, it's early evening in the United States, and that probably moms and dads on the sofa were probably having to explain to their child, who was saying, "Mommy, why is that dead child on the television?" But what I wanted to ask you about this is there anything of the process of the confused.com and we buy any car.com in that the commercials are hated, confused.com, we hate them, but they score by sort of on brand recognition, in that you might hate the meerkats, but when you want to check car insurance costs, you can only remember compare the meerkat. And so that in that way, if you're looking for insurance in the United States, although you may have sort of hated the Nationwide ad, you suddenly think, insurance, Nationwide. So it's recognition.
Yeah, that's, of course. Yes, that's absolutely the point. Particularly these kind of spots in the Super Bowl where they're not expecting everybody to immediately pick up the phone in one fell swoop and take out new insurance with Nationwide. As you say, what they are wanting is people to associate the safety of their family with this particular brand when the time comes to make that purchase. So it is awareness raising, absolutely.
In the aftermath of the airing of the commercial during the Super Bowl, Nationwide Insurance has said that the purpose of the ad was not to sell more of their product, but to, quote, start a conversation, not sell insurance. We want to build awareness of an issue that is near and dear to all of us, the safety and well-being of our children, end of quote. And that's the kind of company statement that means you can't dissent to it in America, isn't it? Because if they throwed in a reference to mom's apple pie and respect for the flag, everyone would be in tears and carrying Nationwide banners in the streets of middle America.
Yeah, I mean, that's just so much prattle, I'm afraid, because had they spent their $4.5 million on a 30-second commercial and it didn't lead to an increase in subscriptions, I don't think they'd be sitting in the boardroom saying, "Hey, it's not a problem, chaps. Absolutely not a problem." Because at least we've helped introduce America to the hot topic of childhood accidents in the home. That is not what they would be saying. They would be saying, "We've wasted $4.5 million on this. Why aren't we getting more sales?" It's all about sales, of course it is.
Perfect Madison Avenue accent there.
Thank you.
Absolutely marvellous. Now, hey diddly dee, it's a pirate's life for me. After nearly 2 months, after nearly 2 months grounded on a reef since police raids on their Swedish data centre, the file sharing site, the Pirate Bay, appears to have set sail again this week.
Yeah.
A sizable number of internet service providers block access to the Pirate Bay, but as with almost any element at all of the internet, as one door is locked, others are copying keys and opening 100 other doors to gain access to the Pirate Bay and other sites. Magnus Shaw, the Pirate Bay is like the Hydra in Greek mythology. You cut off one of its servers and it grows two more in its place. Mm. Can anything be done to stop file sharing on your internet?
No, of course it can't. I'm not surprised to see that Pirate Bay is back. And this is one of the rare situations where somebody, or a few people actually, have been to prison for their for their websites, which indeed they have. And yet there it is back again. I do think the more the man goes after file sharing sites, I think there's a an instinct in the people who run them to push back even harder and ensure that the site comes back up again, sort of without delay. I could name, I shan't, but I could name several sites which have been trading in inverted commas without interruption or disturbance. Since the first iteration of Pirate Bay, without without any scrutiny or legal challenge, so I don't know why they particularly go after Pirate Bay each time.
I think because of its profile. You're absolutely right. Of course, well, I mean, one can, with the most barest grasp of file sharing knowledge, go to literally a thousand other Pirate Bays and torrent sites with their servers somewhere in a mountain in the Himalayas.
Yes, exactly.
You know, absolutely no problem. it's a nice coffee you have there.
I'm sorry. I'm suffering with a really hefty cold here. But
Have a cigarette. That'll
help. Always does.
It always helps. I'm somewhat between a rock and a hard place because I honestly can understand the temptation to obtain something for nothing, especially when it feels like there's little chance of being caught. I do understand, but you know, I'm putting on a pompous hat now because as an artist and particularly as a writer, I see my work all over file sharing sites, and of course, in common with my fellow strivers, I get no income from that whatsoever.
That's right.
I mean, there is an extraordinary dilemma on copyright because many acts of piracy have become accepted practice. If I write a book and you, Magnus Shaw, go out and buy it and enjoy it, and you think, well, I'm going to give that to a work colleague or whatever because, you know, they'll enjoy it too. That's piracy because I'm deprived of the income from that protection so I can sell. Yet society deems that practice pretty much acceptable, you know. Nobody would query it. But if you were to put, say, my novel, the Kindle version of my book, on Pirate Bay, well, that's frowned upon. But the outcome is the same. No money for the author.
Well, I think we've said before, the problem is really in the making of both sides of the argument. So, clearly these people are allowing users. I mean, we should be clear here. These are not downloadable files from these sites. I think everybody knows now that, that all they do is allow you to connect to people who have the file that you want.
They're aggregators, aren't they? In the way, they are like a Google for...
They sort of are, yes.
Yeah, okay.
They sort of are. And you don't, of course, then download the file from one other user. You download lots of little particles of the file from everybody who has it. So that's what a torrent is. So they're not actually distributing anything, which is always their argument. It doesn't seem to prevent them from going to prison now and again, but it's what is the argument that they try. It was ludicrous to say that people who run Pirate Bay and Mega Download and all these sites are whiter than the driven snow. No, they're up to no good, that is for sure. But the opportunity has been missed time and time again by the man, the authorities, the law, the entertainment industry, to engage with these people and say, okay, well, you've got a vast knowledge of how this kind of system can work. Why don't you come and do it for us? And we'll all make some money. And so will the artists and authors and directors whose material we can distribute this way. That has never been attempted. And I think that is the only the only approach, which is ever going to see this resolved. Otherwise, we're just going to see a cat and mouse situation roll on interminably, and lots of lawyers get very fat in the process.
Well, that's, of course, how Napster became, in a sense, Spotify, isn't it? That exact process. That
exactly.
There was a sort of illegal element to it, and over the years, it changed into a way where we'll still do it, but we'll make sure that everybody gets a bit of the money.
And in the analog world, you and I both remember pirate radio stations. Indeed, we both appeared on pirate radio stations.
Indeed,
and the only way that ever got resolved, because of course there are pirate radio stations in every city that you go to this day, the only way that ever had a glimmer of being resolved, and it was a strategy that was very quickly abandoned, was to go to the very successful ones and say, okay, you know how to make a radio station popular. Why don't you have a license, pay your fees, pay your transmitter fees, pay your PRS and your MCPS, as it was back then, fees, and do it properly, or don't do it at all. And, of course, that's what gave us Kiss FM, probably the most famous example, but several other stations, enjoy commercial success to this day because the authorities engage with them and say, okay, if you're so good at this, let's do it properly.
And then that journey of Kiss FM from pirate to today has led them to this very week in the latest Rage Our Stats. They're now the most listened to station in London. So what a journey. This business, I just want to go back to this business of torrents and, the argument that, it's not really piracy because, we're only giving, everybody's giving a little sort of piece. If we go back to my I've written a book analogy, and someone comes around my house and let's say I've written a book of 350 pages, 350 people come around my house and take one page each.
Yeah.
And then as soon as they get outside, they staple it all together.
They've
got a book.
Yeah,
they got my book and I haven't been paid.
I wasn't arguing that torrenting wasn't piracy. I was just saying that it's that there are nuances and subtleties to what Pirate Bay do. It's not just that they offer stuff to, they don't offer any, they would claim they don't offer anything other than a platform across which people can share files, and their argument is it's not up to them to police what those files are, but the authorities take a far different view from that.
Some commentators are speculating that the return of the Pirate Bay this week is a confidence trick, and that it's being run by the FBI so that they can get everybody's IP addresses. So I would say beware.
It's not impossible. We shouldn't give tutorials on these things, but there's a very, very easy and obvious way that you could use the FBI's Pirate Bay and not reveal your IP address. But I'll leave other people to work out what that might be.
Well, what we're going to do now, Magnus Shaw, we're going to move on to the third in our exciting series of Magnus Shaw Tells Us Something. If you only do one thing this week, then do this, Magnus Shaw.
That new jingle just makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck.
I ordered that from Pam's in Dallas.
Yes, yes. Pam's House of Jingles. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Well, I love it. I love it every time I hear it. Yes. Okay. Well, this week, I'm afraid I've culled something from what you incorrectly referred to as My Guardian.
Oh, Lord.
In fact, It isn't anything that's proprietorial to The Guardian. I think they just buy this stuff in. But it's where I became aware of a couple of guys called Berger. Now, I think it's Berger, but rather than Berger. Berger and Wise. I've only ever seen it written down, so I'm guessing it's Berger. In one of their many rejigs of their weekend magazine, The Guardian do like to reinvent their weekend magazine more or less on a weekly basis. But in one of the many rejigs, they decided, and I quite like this idea, they decided to have a cartoon on their food page. For it is cartoons we're talking about. I'd never seen this done before. So alongside the recipe and the restaurant review and Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall looks at lettuce heads or whatever it was that week, there would be a food-oriented cartoon. Which is great. I think it's a great idea. I've never seen that done before. What was particularly rewarding was that it was really funny. Every week it was really funny. And it would either involve human beings in culinary situations, or it would involve actual food in a sort of anthropomorphic way, talking. But they were always really, really funny. They always grabbed me. And then the next time they did the rejig, yeah, like I say, happens quite a lot. These cartoons, which were by the aforementioned Berger and Wise, were given freer rein, and they got their own spots to do cartoons on whatever subject they saw fit. And they are always, always clever, witty, and entertaining. But what I really like about them is that they are never cruel, and they are never too dark. They are never spiteful. They are always have a sort of innocence to them, which I really enjoy, but a little sting in the tail, whereby always says something very interesting about the human condition, something absurd about the human condition, or something that you would recognize, and often something that had never occurred to you about the human condition. It's often in one panel. I think it's almost always in one panel with very few words. It's kind of minimal cartooning, but manages to say a lot. So they're really clever guys. You can see some of their work on their website, and they post stuff there quite often. Obviously, they don't give everything away. That's their client, The Guardian, that does that. They're not quite as stupid as The Guardian, but they often post recent work on their website for you to have a look at. I'm sure you could probably Google some of their cartoons as Google images, or indeed when they publish their stuff in collections, go and buy one, because every single panel they do is really a joy to behold. They're called Berger and Wise. You can see them in the Weekend magazine, in The Guardian, or indeed online, and as they gain more traction in various other places as well. But I love their work.
I wondered why I hadn't heard of Joe Berger and Pascal Wise, and then on checking found, as you say, of course, they were contributors to Your Money Burning Guardian.
That's right.
And so they're probably on 10,000 quid a week.
possibly, yeah.
Alan Rusbridge throwing money at them. No, have some more. Scott Trust, you know, says you must have more. Initially, I took against them because they call people folks in their Twitter feed. Hello folks, and that put me off them a bit, and that, and they say, oh, we've updated our site, friends, in their Twitter feed. I had friends, folks, comrades, chums. I hate all that.
But then, misanthrope.
But their work is excellent. Yes, yeah. I really enjoy. I went to their website, both individually and their collective website, and I hadn't heard of them or seen their work before because of them, you know, being in Your Guardian.
Yes.
But no, this is excellent, and as you say, they follow that great tradition of one panel cartoonists, in that terribly difficult to get over both a lovely picture and a sort of witty message all in one panel, but they manage it. Absolutely excellent, and I've enjoyed looking at their work over the last couple of days.
Well, I hope they'll forgive me that I've posted one of their panels on the Rocking Vicar website, so I hope they don't mind that being it's in an appreciation of what they do. So
I'm sure with The Guardian, you know, taking their salary round in wheelbarrows.
Exactly. And you can see that on the If You Only Do One Thing This Week page of the Rocking Vicar website, yes.
Okay. Well, it made me think of my favourite cartoons. Billy the Fish.
Yeah.
Matt in the Telegraph. Alf Tupper, the tough of the track from the Victor. The Gambles in the Daily Express. Billy's Boots in Roy of the Rovers comics. But, you know, your reference to cartoons, it reminded me on that subject of how much I miss Punch magazine. I subscribe today to Punch. If some media magnate, you know, with money to burn, and maybe again it's one for Alan Rusbridger, you know, brought it back, because one of the joys of Punch, I don't know if you're too young to remember it, because
I remember Punch extremely well. It was in our house as I grew up. Yeah, Private Eye and Punch were always in the house.
Splendid quality of the cartoons. Yeah. Honeysett, Heath, Folks, Larry in particular, yeah. Another generally one panel man, Bill Tidy, Trog. You know, it was a joy to find the these sort of glorious cartoons in and amongst the you know, the humorous columns and articles.
Yeah, so you've reminded me now of a Larry panel in a Punch, actually. Always stuck in my mind as absolutely perfect. Really, really beautiful drawing, actually. Just a few lines and a bit of shadow and the whole thing came to life, you know. But I really admire people who can do that. And it's a fellow sitting there, standing there, rather, with a bunch of flowers and a collection of cigarette butts around his feet. And behind him, which he can't see because it's behind his head, there's one of those street maps that says, "You are here." And next to that, a few streets away, it says, "She is here."
Yeah.
I always, really good. The gag is told with spare minimalism, which is really, really impressive. Yeah.
Cartoons in newspapers and magazines enrich our days for sure. So, yes, Berger and Wise, and you can find out a little bit more about them or a link to their work on your, if you only do one thing this week, then do yep. this
there's a page. There's a link there, and there's a panel that you might enjoy if you go and have a look at it. Okay.
Well, extraordinary though it seems, here at the start of 2015, before 1989, you couldn't see what was happening in Parliament in the House of Commons because television cameras were not allowed in. I feel most believe it can only enhance democracy if we're able to see it in action, yet most of us really only see any parliamentary action on the news when there's been some sort of incident or when we see and hear the barrage of noise that is the weekly jiggery-pokery of Prime Minister's questions. This week, BBC Two showed the first episode of 4 of Michael Cockerell's Inside the Commons. It was filmed over the course of a year, and Cockerell was given what has been described as unparalleled access. So, a singing tea lady and some blokes cleaning Big Ben did Inside the Commons endear you to your much-cherished democratic process?
You know how much I was looking forward to this series going out.
Yes.
As a bit of a political bore, or to be kinder to myself, maybe a political geek. I thought that this was probably the highlight of the televisual year. As you say, unprecedented access to the House of Commons. What wasn't to like? Well, as it turned out, quite a lot, really. What I wasn't expecting was quite such a hagiography, quite such an appreciation of the House of Commons. I wanted to see some real skullduggery, some real cut and thrust of the political arena, and passions simmering and boiling over, and resentment, and a real life version of the West Wing, or even the thick of it. What I actually got was not that different from those shows you see where they go behind the scenes of a hotel or a restaurant or whatever, where everybody's a little bit eccentric, but a little bit charming, and everything's done with a bit of a nod and a wink to the camera, and look what they're doing now, the old fluffer. And it was just too soft and gentle for me. I mean, clearly, you get what you get. I mean, you take a camera crew into any place, you get what you get. But you also get what you go after. And this was just a little bit too gentle for a place which is anything but. So whilst, I now know that the clerk of the house, who actually, as we watched, retired early, but I do know that he was played by Orson Welles. I do know that, but is that what I wanted to know? No, not particularly. We had the obligatory pizzicato soundtrack, didn't we, that goes with every behind-the-scenes documentary, which made me yawn and say, come on, when you were adding this, did you think, where have I heard this before? That's really very lazy to just do what everybody else is doing. Yeah, we met characters like Gladys, the tea room lady, who was wonderful, but I needed the light and shade. So as well as Gladys, I wanted to see you know, the 1922 committee plotting the downfall of somebody. That's what I wanted to know. That's what I wanted to see. Perhaps you can't get that. Perhaps you never will get that. But that's what I was hoping for, and I didn't get it.
You mentioned Gladys, and that reminded me of something that did strike me, is that the ethnic representation in this first episode was made up entirely of people serving tea and sweeping floors.
Yes.
Which may say something about...
Yes, it certainly does. Yes, that didn't pass me by either. No, exactly. Yeah.
Yes, there was quite an element of cap doffing from the from behind the camera, I felt. It was like, gosh, aren't we lucky to be in here?
Yeah.
Rather than, as you say, that, you know, carving their way through the narrative.
Very reverential.
It was very reverential. I just got to mention the clerk of the house, Sir Robert Rogers, who you mentioned, you know, we saw putting in his letter of resignation. Oh my God, what a, well, I was going to say delicious, but I'm not so sure. His fruity manner of speaking.
Fruity, yes, he was, yeah. He was wonderful, that absolutely wonderful character, and could only be produced by... you know, by the British establishment.
I would love to know more about his story, because has he always been like that? Because I was trying to imagine him as a boy at school.
Yes.
With that manner and that speaking voice, that tone of voice.
Has he always waxed his eyebrows, for instance?
Yes, indeed. And, you know, was he quite that pretentious at school? I mean, it was... Lovely aerial of shots, of course, presumably by drone, which is the new norm now, isn't it? You send up a drone with a camera on it.
It'll soon get very boring, I'm afraid.
It was quite interesting to see some aspects, you know, the rather absurd process of sticking prayer cards by a seat to reserve your place, while the unparliamentary hair of Michael Fabricant, you know, it's always a joy to see his... There was some good.
What is that about?
Yes. He refers to it as, he absolutely denies that it's actually a wig, but he says there is an element of construction about his hair, Michael Fabricant. So,
yes, I've always thought if anybody ever took a sample of Michael Fabricant's hair and ran a lab test on it, they'd come back and say, "This is a substance that exists nowhere else on Earth." I think it's extraterrestrial, isn't it? Yeah.
This is the most extraordinary confection. It certainly is. Apart from the, as I say, I think I said cap doffing element. It did highlight some sort of splendid contrast. You know, you had the father of the house, Sir Peter Tapsell, in his Stone Age manner. And then we saw the new younger women MPs, two of which I rather warmed to. There was Charlotte Leslie, the Conservative, the lady we saw boxing. I kind of warmed to her, but she said she's always angry, and I always worry when people say, "Oh, I'm always angry about something." Well,
probably me, actually.
Yeah, I always think, you know, choose your targets. Don't be angry about life. You know,
yes,
but I suppose the star of the show, if there was such a thing, was the Labour MP, your Labour MP. Sarah Champion,
yeah.
A little unfortunately telling the caterer in the canteen that she was changing the law today, which was sort of playing to the camera, because she then had to withdraw her amendment.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't change the law that day, but in the end, she came over terribly well as a, you know, a well-meaning, hard, you know, working and there for all the right reasons. And, of course, this was filmed over the last year, but of course, Sarah Champion, MP for Rotherham, I should say, Labour MP for Rotherham, came back in
town one would relish a seat in at the moment.
Going to say she came back into the news this week and made an excellent contribution to the terrible reports that have come out of Rotherham well over the last year, but particularly the report this week.
We've just seen the council resign en masse. They've been replaced by wonks from Westminster, haven't we? So I guess it's quite a challenging time for Sarah Champion. You're absolutely right. She did give the lie to this notion that all politicians are venal, self-serving demons. And clearly, she's been in Parliament. How long has she been in Parliament now? Four years? Did she come in the last election?
I think so, yes.
I think that's what was suggested.
Certainly newish, yes.
Yeah, newish. So, you know, one hopes that she doesn't become too jaded, too much cynicism doesn't rub off on her. But, yeah, she did a good PR job for the grassroots MP, I have to say, although, as I say, challenging times. But there were things in the documentary that did open my eyes to a few things. So did you see the size of the sheaf of paper that constituted a new bill going from the Commons to the Lords? Did you see how many pages that consisted of? I mean, no wonder these lawyers charged the big bucks. Somebody had to read all that. In fact, somebody had to write all that. Is this necessary? And how can we reasonably be expected to defend ourselves if we break any of the laws that are created when each one is, 10,000 pages long? I don't know.
I completely agree. It sounds like I'm puffing myself up here, but I've got to tell a little anecdote because I got into a great deal of trouble about going on about this. And one of my rare visits, I was actually asked, the lady who's presenting the Rotherham report, Louise Casey, actually worked with her.
Oh, okay.
I was on a board invited by Baroness Newlove, whose husband was sort of tragically murdered in 2007.
Absolutely.
And we were looking at antisocial behaviour, naturally, and how it can escalate. And we did a report, and it exactly mirrored what you said. It was so huge in terms of the numbers printed and amount of paper used in it that I said, look, you know, we could have done this digitally. We could have done an executive summary. And, you know, I was sort of not by, I must say, Helen Newlove or Louise Casey, but by the people behind the scenes at Parliament, it was House of Lords, in fact. This is democracy in action. This is what we do. And it was
the more paper, the freer we are. Is
absolutely.
That,
and, you know, I was very troubled by that. But it was interesting to see that the Clerk of the House, Sir Robert Rogers, did make a big point about saying, well, we are going digital and we are reducing the amount of paper.
He seemed to be pushing in that direction. I mean, the astonishing revelation that at the time of making the film, which was May last year, I think, that MPs had only just got Wi-Fi in their offices.
Yes, yes.
I mean, presumably they're with the same provider I am.
Yes, yes. The horse and cart outside.
In all seriousness, can you believe that if you're, as an MP, you've only just got Wi-Fi in your office as of May last year, less than 12 months ago? Incredible. Incredible.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it is, I mean, you know, anyone who's been there, but certainly you could see from this building, the Palace of Westminster itself is rather troubling. The building it appears to be falling to bits.
Which makes sense if you think of its age. And
I hope that's not a metaphor for our democracy.
One wonders. Yeah, we'll see in May. I'll let you know after the first week of May. Yeah,
Mr. Cameron and Mr. Miliband, I thought they were charmingly honest about their fear of Prime Minister's questions. But then, of course, we saw some clips of it, and of course, PMQs, it looked and sounded awful because so many MPs just, they don't get that we hate all that yelling, you know, and the posturing.
Well, they don't care. I think they know that we hate it and they don't care. They're going to do it anyway because they think what they want to do is more important than what we want them to do.
I was surprised that nobody, it wasn't really sort of picked up, and maybe we're supposed to pick it up ourselves, as a sort of grammatical faux pas from David Cameron, the Prime Minister, because he said the House of Commons is half museum, half church and half school, which is like three halves, you know.
And also I thought it might look like your old school, mate, but it doesn't look like many of the schools that we went to. It probably looks like your old school, but you can't have three halves, can you? No, that's right. I really like some brilliant special effects there. Did you notice that bit where they brought in the CGI there? Really brilliant. I mean, Eric Pickles managed to get through that gate into the lobby.
Oh, that's cruel. That's cruel. And speaking of large men, Nicholas Soames rolled up very briefly. And I was intrigued because he was wearing skull and crossbones braces.
Yes, he was.
Like a Pirate Bay braces. Supporter. Yeah, Pirate Bay or punk rock. Yeah,
he's one of the great characters of the Commons, isn't he?
There's just one other thing I was going to mention about that we saw, which was the awkwardness. The splendid awkwardness of George Osborne when he was meeting his parliamentary team just before they set off to deliver the budget.
Yes.
And hello there, Charles, and hello, Fiona. Do come in. But it reminded me, him surrounded there, it did remind me of Wolf Hall and Henry VIII with his advisors, everybody surrounding him. But
that's what I wanted, you see. I wanted a modern day Wolf Hall. That's what I was. The intrigue. I wanted the intrigue of the Commons, and I didn't really get. It just smacked of an other, fly on the wall documentary, of which there are so many now. And if it was such a groundbreaking moment in broadcasting, it didn't feel like one. It was just so tamed. Where was the tension? Where was the jeopardy? It's too much like those. In the hotel kitchen documentaries, a ten a penny. You know?
It rather was. Yeah. I mean, it's the first episode of four, and
we'll see
whether it's more revelations to be had.
Grainy, yes. I do hope so. Yeah.
This was Inside the Commons. It was on BBC Two on Tuesday at 9 p.m. If you want to watch it, do be aware that the BBC website states that it's only going to be on the iPlayer for a week. Which is most bizarre. Yeah. I can't even account for that. Why some programs are on there for eternity and some for a week. I don't know.
Feel very anti-democratic, actually.
It rather would, wouldn't it? It was this Inside the Commons was produced by Emma Whitlock, and it was written and presented by Michael Cockerell.
And that about puts the tarpaulin back on the parish council for another week, I'm afraid. We're off to dinner with our business backer. Is it Bob or Bill or Mike? No, Phil.
Anyway,
I'll check with Ed Balls. He'll know. So thanks to our exec producer, Rona Martin, and she did the introductions at the top of the piece this week. And as ever, our thanks to the translucent Terence Stackham for his contribution. Most of all, to you, though, our thanks. Our favourite listener, we're glad you could be with us. And there's more over at therockingvicar.com. That's therockingvicar.com. And we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to a podcast from The Rocking Vicar.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.